is, for example, the European Union and other entities and countries dealing with resources that you say are stolen from the Sahrawi people? How successful have you been in getting them to stop buying them?
I think one of the main achievements of Sahrawis have been at the European Court of Justice different resolutions from 2015 until last one, September 2021, when it says that the European Union and Morocco could not engage in a commercial agreement that involves Western Sahara. Because the European Court of Justice considers the Western Sahara territory as separate and distinct from the Moroccan territory, and this is one of the main achievements. However,
Sahrawi climate activist Mahfoud Beshri with Western Sahara is not for sale. I spoke to him at the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el Sheikh, Egypt. To see all of our coverage of the COP in Sharm el Sheikh, as well as our coverage from Cairo, Egypt, you can go to democracynow.org. Also there, you can watch our documentary, 4 Days in Occupied Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Furti, Nagesda Messiah, Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlin. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer...
are turning to the legislature for relief, and a recent leak in the Snake River dams call their viability into question. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News from Monday, November 28, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's controversial plan to ban homeless camping in the city and force people into mass encampments hasn't received the funding support from the county that he had hoped for. But the council will vote Wednesday on going ahead with the plan, even though they lack the needed funds to fulfill it. Last week, an emergency funding down payment of $27 million narrowly failed by a council vote. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty was the lone no vote, and now that the plan is no longer considered emergency, it is very likely to pass. Testimony against the proposal from the public was scathing, calling the plan cruel, inhumane, and fiscally irresponsible. The price tag of $27 million is only a start to the kind of funds that are needed to make good on Wheeler's plan. So far, the funding requests he's made to Multnomah County have gone nowhere. Wheeler asked for $21 million, and the county chair has not made any indication she would meet that request. But on Thursday, Portland City Council voted to withhold $8 million from the Joint Office of Homeless Services next year if they didn't allocate money for rent assistance and eviction defense in December. Portland and Multnomah County pool money together into the joint office to work on the issue. Now it seems to have reached a tipping point. Portland City Council demands the county invest in its controversial homeless camping ban and mass encampments, or they will pull funding from the joint office. Portland City Council will vote Wednesday on allocating $27 million of its own revenue towards the plan. More news on the issue of housing. A supportive housing fund approved by voters in 2020 will get a closer look from an oversight committee now that it's been in action for a year. Metro's supportive housing fund has placed 1,669 people into homes in its first year. The fund supports efforts by Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties, and now those first year of efforts are up for review. The recent number of placements is slightly higher than previously thought. Numbers published in August were less than the total impact, since one county undercounted the people it helped by about 60. The fund is supported by a tax on high-income individuals and businesses with gross revenue above $5 million. Counties also used Metro funds to increase shelter capacity, provide rental assistance, and help prevent evictions. Supportive housing includes places to live as well as services to help support that, like case management support and rental assistance. Multnomah County placed 1,129 people into housing, which was just a fraction of the 4,560 people who received permanent housing in the county through other funding sources. Clackamas placed 170 people into housing with a long-term goal of providing 1,065 supported housing units over 10 years through the Supportive Housing Fund. Despite all those efforts, houselessness remains an ongoing problem. A recent count estimated that the unhoused population in Multnomah County exceeded 5,000 people in January of this year. Providing permanent housing remains a statewide objective. Earlier this year, the state surpassed its goal of providing 1,000 affordable housing units by 2023. The second year of the 10-year program is currently underway, and next year, counties will be collecting more data, and that might include things like the retention rate for people housed using the funds. Metro's Regional Housing Director Patricia Rojas said, quote, "We are making significant progress in just the first year of a 10-year effort, and that's just incredibly exciting for all of us to see. We want to see a system where, if somebody falls into homelessness, that they don't stay there for long, that we are able to quickly respond with housing and services so that individual does not become chronically homeless." End of quote. Well, it's not news that Oregon nurses have been through a lot in recent years, but a legislative proposal would ensure that hospitals have enough staff to meet their patients' needs in the future. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
Oregon nurses are urging state lawmakers to make hospitals better and safer places to work. With the 2023 legislative session just around the corner, the Oregon Nurses Association is calling for changes that will ensure minimum staffing standards based on patient numbers and accountability for hospitals so that there are enough nurses on the floor. Matt Calzia with the Nurses Union says the lack of staffing has real implications for patients. For instance, if a nurse goes on break for lunch, another nurse assumes care of their patients, doubling the other nurse's workload during that time.
So when you've just had knee surgery, and if that period of time falls when you need your next pain medication dose, it may be delayed because right now your nurse actually has 8 patients instead of 4.
Calzia says turnover is higher now than during the Delta wave of the pandemic because nurses are burnt out. According to ONA, turnover was 27% in 2021. However, Sean Colmer with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems says that under the union's proposal, community hospitals will have no choice but to reduce access to services if they are unable to hire enough staff, and that there's a staffing shortage in the state. Paige Spence is Director of Government Relations with ONA. She says along with minimum safe staffing requirements, the union proposal would ensure Oregon's current staffing law is enforceable and provide accountability when nurses make complaints. In addition, Spence says an annual review of the staffing plan would include the number of missed meal and rest breaks over the past year.
To ensure that the staffing levels going forward are robust enough to accommodate nurses' abilities to take the meal and rest breaks, which they, A, need for sanity and physical well-being and also are entitled to by law.
Calzia says it's important to note the state does not have a shortage of nurses.
It's not a pipeline issue, it's a turnover issue. You have more nurses leaving the bedside than you can get in, and then you're just burning through them.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Multnomah County leaders are considering a ban on the sale of flavored tobacco products like mentholated cigarettes, e-cigarettes, hookah products, and other flavored nicotine products. This is despite the fact that a similar ban was overturned in Washington County in September. The judge there reasoned that a ban like that would have to come from the state level. County leaders are hosting a public hearing this evening at 5:30 p.m. and are scheduled to vote on Thursday. Those leaders have pointed to studies that show flavored e-cigarettes were the most commonly used tobacco product for middle and high school students. They also point to other studies that show policies like a ban on flavored tobacco products have been effective in other places by keeping young people from becoming addicted to nicotine. Public Health Director Jessica Guernsey points out that tobacco companies market their mentholated and flavored products specifically to Black, Latina, and Native American residents. Guernsey said, quote, "The restricted sale of flavored tobacco, including menthol, directly ties to what it means to address racism as a public health crisis," end of quote. If the ban passes, it won't punish people for using flavored tobacco products. Since it's a public health law, it would be up to public health officers to enforce the ban by monitoring retail sales and holding shopkeepers accountable if they sell the banned products. President Biden will push for an assault weapons ban, and Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy is still trying to secure enough votes to be Speaker. That's all before the new Congress is seated in January. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The idea we still allow semi-automatic weapons to be purchased is sick. It's just sick. It has no social redeeming value. Zero. None.
President Biden says he'll push for a ban on assault weapons during the lame duck session of Congress. This follows a mass shooting at an LGBTQ plus Colorado Springs nightclub that killed 5 and another at a Chesapeake, Virginia Walmart where 6 died. The Colorado shooter used an AR-15-style rifle, while the Virginia man bought the handgun he turned on his coworkers the same day. Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, is running for president again in 2024. The rapper and fashion designer ran in 2020 and got about 70,000 votes. He says he asked former President Donald Trump to be his running mate, but it didn't go well.
The thing that Trump was most perturbed about, me asking him to be my vice president, I think that was like lower on the list of things that caught him off guard. It was the fact that I walked in with intelligence.
Ye and Trump were joined at a Mar-a-Lago meeting last week by prominent white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. Trump said the meeting was quick and uneventful. Republican leader Kevin McCarthy is still trying to lock in the 218 votes he needs to be elected Speaker of the House. Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene called on her Republican colleagues to support McCarthy's bid.
If we don't unify behind Kevin McCarthy, we're opening up the door for the Democrats to be able to recruit some of our Republicans, and they may only need one or two since we don't know what we will have in the majority, how many seats we'll have.
The midterm elections did not bring the red wave many were expecting, and what looks to be a very narrow Republican majority in the House is presenting a challenge for McCarthy. The Biden administration eased some oil sanctions on Venezuela Saturday. After years of restrictions, the Treasury Department is allowing Chevron to resume limited pumping in the oil-rich Latin American nation. This comes after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro signed a temporary agreement with the U.S.-backed opposition, creating a U.N.-managed humanitarian fund with assets frozen overseas. A new analysis from civil rights group, the Council of American Islamic Relations, found that Muslims won at least 83 seats nationwide, up from 71 in 2020. Nabila Islam made history as the first ever Muslim woman and youngest woman ever elected to the Georgia Senate.
And I always like to say, when you're not at the table, you're on the menu. We see what's happening to us right now. And the only way to change this is making sure that we elect leaders who share lived experiences.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our HRS indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Georgia's ban on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy has now been reinstated by the state Supreme Court there. The order comes after a lower court ruled 2 weeks ago that the ban was unconstitutional and adds another dimension to the hotly contested U.S. Senate runoff election. An advocacy group that represents abortion providers and women's right to choose is challenging the ban. Danielle Smith has more.
The Georgia Supreme Court granted an emergency stay of a lower court's ruling, once again allowing a six-week abortion ban to take effect in Georgia while an appeals process continues. The ban prohibits abortion from the earliest weeks of pregnancy, at least for now. Andrea Young, executive director of the ACLU of Georgia, says the hold will negatively affect anyone seeking to end a pregnancy, especially those who are uninsured or low income. Judge Robert McBurney ruled earlier this month that the six-week abortion ban was void when it was passed because it was unconstitutional.
That ruling was appealed by the state of Georgia, Governor Kemp and Attorney General Carr. The Supreme Court stayed Judge McBurney's order while they deliberate on the merits of his decision. So his decision is not overturned, but it is not in effect anymore.
The state's abortion ban law was passed in 2019, but took effect in July of this year after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Roe versus Wade decision, giving states the power to restrict abortion. In 2020, the Georgia Department of Public Health reported more than 37,000 abortions in the state. Young explained some people may have scheduled abortions that were unable to be performed in Georgia because of the court ruling. She adds those people should contact their providers, as many clinics are seeing patients and advising them based on the status of their pregnancies.
If there is cardiac fetal activity, after about 6 weeks, abortion is not currently available in the state of Georgia.
Young adds early voting for the Georgia Senate runoff election begins today, and one of the candidates would likely support a national ban on abortion. She notes right now, Georgians who are pregnant have the option to go to other states, including Illinois, Michigan, and New York, where state laws protect abortion access.
If we had a national ban, that could go away. So it does matter who's in the Senate. Obviously, one of these candidates would oppose a national ban, and one of them would likely support a national ban. They're on record as being, you know, against the right to choose.
She adds Asheville, North Carolina is the closest place to Metro Atlanta where abortions are still available later in the first trimester of pregnancy. I'm Danielle Smith, Georgia News Connection.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7 p.m., Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast, partly cloudy tonight with an overnight low of 33. Tomorrow, rainy and a high of 42. Today in history, a number of countries gained their independence. Panama in 1821, Albania in 1912, Mauritania in 1960, and East Timor in 1975. The quote of the day is from Canadian-American actor Leslie Nielsen, who died this day in 2010. He was best known for his roles in Airplane and the Naked Gun series. Nielsen said, quote, "I am serious, and don't call me Shirley." A grassroots community group called the Echo Park Trash Club in Los Angeles is taking a more person-centered approach to cleaning up the trash left by people living in homeless encampments. Suzanne Potter spoke with the group's founder.
Community members in one Los Angeles neighborhood are trying out a more humane way to approach the trash buildup around homeless encampments. The Echo Park Trash Club, now in its second year, meets just about every other Sunday and hauls away refuse. But they ask permission, treat residents with dignity, kindness, and respect, and don't try to make anyone move. Critics of the approach say it makes the encampments more permanent. But Aaron Fine, a therapist in training who founded the club, says the city's sweeps are inhumane and cruel.
Let's do away with sweeps altogether. While we have so many people that don't have affordable permanent housing, we need to do this in a completely different way. We can't be scaring people. We can't be throwing their homes in the trash. We shouldn't be bringing police officers. It's got to be done differently.
In March 2021, the city of LA shut down a large encampment at Echo Park Lake. The operation used 480 police officers who arrested 183 protesters, including some members of the Echo Park Trash Club, and detained about 20 journalists. Now the city has joined forces with the Trash Club, providing a trash truck at each cleanup event. At the cleanups, 20 to 40 volunteers fan out over a 4-hour period and remove 2 to 4 tons of trash. Fine notes that there are no paid employees and says they use GoFundMe campaigns to keep the club going.
We initially raised $10,000 to buy a pickup truck, and we bought shovels and rakes and brooms and sharps containers and gloves and masks and everything you can think of.
People can find out more on the Echo Park Trash Club's website or on their Instagram page, Next Door profile, or online newsletter. This story was produced with original reporting from Caroline Tracy for High Country News as part of the Solutions Journalism Network. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
As folks check off items on their holiday gift buying lists, they are being urged to consider Black business owners. Their support network says this year is especially important as minority-owned businesses try to recover from the pandemic. Mike Moen has more on that recovery in Wisconsin.
The holiday shopping season is here, and people are being reminded about the importance of supporting Black-owned businesses in Wisconsin and elsewhere. A recent Global State of Small Business report, issued by social media company Meta, notes the closure rate for minority-led small firms was 7 percentage points higher than other operations, and more than half led by Black owners reported lower sales than the previous year. Trinity Rush, with the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce, says there's still an uneven recovery from the pandemic. She says by helping these businesses, they can have stronger communities and inspire others to follow suit.
When you talk to people, you do business with people the same background as you, you have that moment to educate them in the way that can relate, that you can more get in tune with them.
Rush has her own business called Trendsetter, which sells beanies and hats designed to protect a person's hairstyle. She says her product has cultural significance for the Black community, although it's useful for other customers as well. And since the racial reckoning, there are calls for consumers and larger companies to be more inclusive in retail and other forms of business. Rush says stronger support for Black-owned businesses, especially those still struggling, coincides with any progress in making their communities more vibrant, such as better access to health coverage. She hopes shoppers keep this in mind when they're planning their purchases.
Now will be a time to come back and support them and help them, you know, get back up and running and just, you know, feed their dreams.
Just 2.5% of businesses in the U.S. are Black-owned, even though nearly 13% of the country's population is Black. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
One of the dams on the Lower Snake River leaked 300 to 600 gallons of oil over the summer. Critics of the dams on that section of the river say it's a sign that they are aging rapidly. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Four dams on the Lower Snake River have been the sites of contention in the Northwest, and a recent report of an oil spill at one of these dams could be adding fuel to that fire. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers reported that 300 to 600 gallons of oil leaked from the Little Goose Dam between August and October. Mitch Cutter with the Idaho Conservation League says there have been similar incidences in recent years of leakage from the Lower Snake dams.
We're seeing the results of these dams being old, frankly. They were started to be constructed in the 60s through the 70s, and I think we're seeing the results of infrastructure starting to outlive its useful life.
There has been a growing chorus of calls to breach the dams to allow for greater passage of endangered salmon and steelhead species in the region. However, there are also opponents of that plan. Washington Republican Congressman Dan Newhouse recently said there is no clean energy future for the Northwest without these dams. Cutter is skeptical of that analysis. He says the cost of keeping the dams has become too high to make financial sense anymore.
They don't provide valuable services to the Northwest system or to the Western energy grid. They can be easily replaced with other resources that can not just replace everything these dams do, they would actually improve on the services they provide to the region.
Cutter also says it's important to keep iconic species such as salmon and steelhead front and center when discussing this issue.
There are real solutions for how to replace everything these dams provide, but there is no replacement for wild salmon and steelhead in Idaho or in the Snake River.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The remote St. George Island, Alaska Native community has solved their water contamination mystery. And Mary Peltola makes history as the first full-term Alaskan Native member of Congress. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. St. George Island is an Alaska Native community that prides itself on its resourcefulness, but that was put to the test after its water system failed. The island is about 200 miles off the coast of Alaska. Only 35 people live there, and they were not able to drink their tap water for almost a month.
It's been pretty murky. It's brown, even boiling. You don't trust to use it for washing dishes.
Anastasia Kashavirov says tribes and native corporations donated supplies of bottled water, which went fast. The public safety building did have water that could be used for cleaning. Kashavirov says families had to haul 5-gallon buckets to their homes to flush toilets and mop floors. This went on for several weeks as crews tried to pinpoint the cause of the problem. Finally, they tracked it down to a broken water line. When the city crew dug into the ground, they were shocked at what they found: a clean break in the pipe that was right on top of a huge rock. The mayor of St. George, Mark Merkuliev, began to wonder if an earthquake caused the damage. One had jolted the island a few days before the water ran out. Although the cause of the break will likely remain a mystery, he says the community learned a lot from the experience.
You know, you got to know the ins and outs of your systems here, and also to be able to, whether it's state agencies or federal agencies, be able to explain situations like that.
The water system was up and running in time for Thanksgiving, but St. George still has to boil its drinking water until the lines are completely flushed out. Mary Peltola, who won a special election to cover the rest of the late Alaska Congressman Don Young's term, went on to become the first Alaska Native woman elected to Congress, and now has become the first Alaska U.S. representative to be elected by ranked choice voting. Last week, when second choice ballots were counted, Peltola received enough to win the race and credits the new system of voting to her election.
I am not liberal leaning enough. I think that at the beginning of the race in the special, there were two individuals that were really favored and chosen, and it was their time, was the feedback that I was getting from a lot of folks within the Democratic establishment.
Peltola won with 54% of the vote, about 10% more than her Republican challenger, former Governor Sarah Palin. Proponents of ranked choice voting say the system helps to elect more moderate candidates and minorities. Peltola says she'll focus on Alaska priorities and will try to balance that with efforts to work on behalf of Native Americans. She says her election gets her a seat at the table, which puts her in a position to help tribes. Native American comedian and writer Janice Schmieding switched gears ahead of her planned visit to the University of Oregon last week. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
Schmieding had planned to do a day full of activities at her alma mater, but tested positive for COVID after landing in Eugene.
I got it at a Smashing Pumpkins concert at the Hollywood Bowl, so we'll blame the Smashing Pumpkins fans.
Instead, Schmieding did visits in a Be Indigenous Joy campus presentation via Zoom to keep people safe. She's a UO alum of the class of 2005 and has written and acted for two Native-themed series, Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs. Schmieding assures fans that her COVID case is mild, she's up on her vaccinations, and she's resting at her parents' place.
I'm not suffering at all, and I'm well taken care of. My mom and my dad are really showing up for me.
Schmieding's relatives, including her brother, grandmother, and a cousin, appeared at the Tuesday event on her behalf. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Pakistan faced deadly floods in 2022, with the disaster killing over 1,500 people and destroying 2 million homes. Now, new information shows that climate change made rains more extreme during the deadly floods this year. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This past summer, powerful monsoon rains in Pakistan caused devastating floods that killed more than 1,500 people and destroyed more than 2 million homes.
It had huge impacts.
Freddie Otto is with the Grantham Research Institute for Climate Change and the Environment at Imperial College London. She was part of a team that analyzed how global warming contributed to the disaster. She says rainfall in the region is highly unpredictable, but after accounting for natural variations and other factors,
we found that climate change did definitely increase the likelihood of rainfall like this quite considerably.
She says some models showed that during the 5 days when rain was most extreme, climate change increased rainfall intensity by up to 50% in the hardest hit provinces. Periods of intense rain are projected to grow more common as warming continues.
We have already seen it in large parts of Asia that especially the short duration heavy rainfall is increasing with climate change.
The risks to people are exacerbated by poverty and poor infrastructure. So as the flooding in Pakistan shows, the consequences of extreme rain can be dire. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 28, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Alex Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. Have a great night.